The Tea Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographers Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop In.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Tea Stop In. I've been away from the podcast shooting, producing and colour grading the feature film Dark Noise, and I'm really looking forward to sharing more about that with you soon. But right now we're back to the long anticipated part two of my conversation with Dean Semler. We pick up where we left off in part one, with Dean about to start the shoot for what was to become his Academy Award winning masterpiece, Dances with Wolves. Dean, what was the shoot for this film really like?
I had a camera assistant called Lee Blassingame,
yeah,
who was from Atlanta, and he was sort of a redneck, but a wonderful photographer. He shot a lot of 8x10, a lot of 4x5, black and whites, did his own processing.
Wow.
And he was a very, very careful, but he was my first assistant. He was good on focus. It was difficult on focus because we were anamorphic.
Yep.
And we had Native American riders. We might have been on a 600mm lens. And they had a stop at a certain point. We couldn't put marks out there on the prairie because you'd see them. You'd have the grass and stuff. We couldn't mark it. Couldn't put bags or anything down. So Blaster, as we called him, Lee Blassingame, he put down little bits of horse shit. Just a few horse droppings at 50 feet, at 75 feet, at 100 feet, at 200 feet. So he had these references all the way. You know?
Wow.
And he did a great job. You know, he might have been shooting at 5.6 on a 600mm. So you've only got a few feet either way and you're out, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, good work, Blast. I'm going to Africa to do a film called The Power of One.
Wow.
You want to come down with me? He said, yeah, sure, Blast. That means I'll be getting bigger marks, right?
There's a story I've been told. I wasn't there for the ACS screening of Dances with Wolves, but there's a story I've been told that somebody asked you how you did all of those spectacular sunsets and that your reply was, at the end of the day, we pointed the camera west.
Well, I hope I said it. It's good. I hope I said it. On one weekend, I was driving in the beautiful country. It was a Sunday, and a cop pulled me up. He said, you were speeding. He said, you were doing 10 miles an hour over the limit. He said, I gave him a license, which was an Aussie license, an Australian license. He said, you're from Australia? And I said, yeah. I said, I'm working over here on the movie. And he was looking at my license. I said, I'm working on the Kevin Costner movie. It's a film called Dances with Wolves with Kevin Costner. He said, yeah. He said, did you shoot any films in Australia? Take them down there. I said, yeah. He said, you didn't work on Road Warrior, did you? I said, yeah, I photographed that. He said, wow. I said, it's one of my favourite films. He said, good for you. He said, anyway, sign the ticket here. And I said, I don't have to sign it. He said, yes, you do. He said, I want your autograph. So I gave him my autograph, and he let me off. He said, just don't drive that fast. He said, be careful. I said, all right. And he was a real friendly country cop, right?
Wow.
So now we were soldiers, and this is 11 years later.
Yeah.
And I'm up north of Stanford, north of Los Angeles, in a place called Paseo Robles.
Yeah.
And I'm on a great country road again, and I'm in my new Beamer. I'm in a Mercedes.
Yeah.
Driving along, and I'm doing 75 or 80 in a 55. There's no cars. There's nothing around except one cop hiding in the bushes.
Yeah.
And he comes out, and he comes to my car, I put the side window down, and I hand over my license, and it's now an American California license. I give it to him, and he's a Hollywood cop by the look of it. He's got the tan, he's got the grey moustache, he's got the mirrored sunglasses, and he's straight out of a Hollywood movie, you know. He's California. And I said, I'm over here working on a movie. Nothing.
Yeah.
He's looking at my license, writing stuff down. I said, it's a movie called We Were Soldiers. Nothing. I said it's got Mel Gibson's the star in it.
Yeah.
He's still writing down stuff. It's funny, you know, I go way back with Mel. I did Road Warrior with him. He turned to me and he said, here's your ticket, buddy. Drive slow. And that was it. I said, no, I'm buggy. It worked once, didn't it?
What was the experience of getting nominated for the Academy Award like?
Sort of unbelievable. I was in Sydney, at home in Sydney, and the phone rang one morning at 1 o'clock, and it was Jim Wilson, the producer, said, hey, mate, you've been nominated. No, he didn't. He said, hey, buddy, you've been nominated.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow. Then I told Annie and jumped up and down, and my daughter was there and went back to sleep. Woke up in the morning thinking, was that a dream or was it real? But it was real. The phone started ringing. It was the press. I'd never been confronted, been approached by press before. But all of a sudden, it was everywhere, and it was very exciting. And then I spoke to Alan Darvio and various other people who'd been through the process, and he said, like, it's about three weeks of having a good time, party time, in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Well, he was right. I mean, the Americans certainly know how to celebrate success. So we travelled to Los Angeles, and there were lunches. There was the official nominees' lunch where everyone was there. And, you know, I was up against Storaro for Dick Tracy, Gordon Willis for The Godfather.
Wow.
Alan Darvio for Avalon and Philippe Russo for Henry and June. I mean, these four guys.
What an extraordinary
year. This little bloke from Renmar. You know, goodness me. So we had the luncheon, and there were Kodak Awards, Kodak Nights, and there was the ASC night, which I won also. And it's funny, at the ASC night, I was as nervous as hell because all of a sudden, I was possibly going to have to make a thank you speech in front of 1,200 people at the Beverly Hilton.
Yeah.
In black tie, 1,200 people, and me getting up on stage. And I was so shit scared. I was terrified. Until an award came up, the lifetime achievement that night went to a guy called Hans Klemmenkamp.
Yeah.
Who was 98.
Wow.
And he'd been an assistant, or he'd worked on films like the very early Keystone Cops and things, and the first Midsummer Night's Dream. And he was a bit frail and bent over. He was old, but there he was in his tux. His son was Fred Klemmenkamp. He was a big guy and still shooting. I think Fred got an Academy Award for Towering Inferno.
Wow.
But he was big. He was in his 60s, 70s or whatever, and he was still active. And the award was announced. People stood up, standing ovation. A little Hans Klemmenkamp stood up, and everyone clapped. Fred was walking up on stage, about to, and his dad grabbed him by the arm and said, "I want to go too."
Wow.
So they went up on stage, and it took forever for little old Hans to get up there. He got up on stage, and he had tears in his eyes. He was speechless, but he stood up there as proud as can be, and he waved his can like he was winding up a camera, like it was hand wound.
Yeah.
And people cheered and went nuts and stuff. And
wow.
I thought after that, I can get up and make this damn speech. I'm not afraid anymore, you know.
Wow.
Which I did. And so that was wonderful.
So were you already a member of the ASC?
That made me a member.
Because it's now a fairly well-trodden path from the ACS to the ASC, but back then you must have been one of the first.
I was the first ACS, yeah.
Wow.
Prior to me, there was Damien Parra.
Really? Wow.
Damien Parra.
That's good company.
Was a wartime cameraman. I don't know if you know of Damien. He was a wartime cameraman.
Yep.
And his stuff is at the National War Museum in Canberra. Extraordinary footage called Frontline or something. And his stuff was always shot ahead or looking back at our soldiers. And, he was killed during the war. I worked with his son, who was born, you know, shortly after the war. He was, during the war, of course, his son was born. And he was a production manager. He still is, I think, down there in Sydney.
Really?
But he got an Academy Award posthumously.
Yeah.
For his work during the war. Academy Awards, going back to 3 days before the Academy Awards, Annie, my wife, went to pick up her dress, which she had designed for a Hollywood filmmaker, dressmaker,
yeah,
costume designer, went to pick it up, and it was disastrous. It was absolutely ridiculous. It was horrible, and there's no way in the world she could have worn it. It was not that it was made badly. It was just ridiculous. It had feathers and shit all over it. It was ridiculous.
Oh, dear.
So Anne was devastated. Absolutely. We had 3 days to go.
Wow.
And there was no time to get another one made. We went to various stores. She couldn't find anything she liked. So the day of, this is a Monday, the day of the Academy Awards, she's absolutely distraught.
Yeah.
She said, go and find someone young who's got a dress and you take them. I said, no, you're coming with me. So I took her into Rodeo Drive. And we went to a place called Fred Hyland's or something.
Mm.
And the assistants in there are all Beverly Hills ladies who are terribly proper and elegant. And they started bringing stuff out for Annie. And bit by bit, the dismay and gradually started to change. Until finally she got in this one dress that was unbelievably gorgeous and
wow,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Had a golden cape that came over the top, and then they had, oh, look at these shoes. And you need this jewellery to go with it. So there she was, and she was, and they were laughing. She's got a great sense of humour. She's as funny as can be.
Yeah.
Swears like a trooper. And they, she had these girls in fits at the end, and she was very, very happy with this thing. I don't know to this day what it costs. I have no idea. It really didn't matter.
Yeah.
And the sad thing was, though, that I wanted to see it the week after and have a look at the towel or whatever, and she'd sold it immediately after.
Oh, really?
She felt so guilty. She sold it. There's a store in Beverly Hills, or more than one, that take dresses off actresses who've worn them once, etc.
Yeah.
And she did that.
Wow.
So we went to the Academy Awards. The limo pulled up at the hotel. It was, the door opened and smoke came out, and there was Graham Greene sitting in there with a big cigar and a glass of scotch. He said, hey, buddy, here we go. And I didn't smoke, and I didn't have scotch. We went to the Academy Awards, did the red carpet,
yeah,
which wasn't quite as spectacular as it is now, but it was still spectacular.
Wow.
A lot of press there, and I bumped into some Aussie press on the way in before we got into the building. And
yeah,
that was really a nice feeling to do a little interview for, I forget who they were from, but did a little interview with them and went inside. And the orchestra, a full orchestra, was playing themes from the movies. And you know, that was Goosebumps time. It was so beautiful.
Wow. Yeah.
And we took our seats, and we were in amongst the other cinematographers whose names I'd mentioned with their wives, and the Academy Awards started and all that, et cetera, et cetera. Madonna was there, Michael Jackson was there, a few other people.
Wow.
But it was wonderful. I got my, they announced my award, and I leapt up out of my seat, and Annie was very pissed off.
Yeah.
And she said, you should have just stopped for taking a beat, give me a little kiss, and then walked up. And then he left like a frightened rabbit, and no one saw me. Oh, all right. I got up on stage. Yeah. I was hoping that I could speak and that my fly was done up and all that. And it was wonderful. There was a night Billy Crystal was there, and he made me feel good because, to me, he was the last greatest showman ever. He was terrific at the introduction. He rode in on a horse. I don't know if you remember, but he rode in on a horse.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
And then he pressed a little button, beep, 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 like the door closed or locked. And I could see him in the distance waiting to come on when I made the speech and stuff. And as I left stage with Glenn Close, I bumped into the Wrangler with his horse. So I stopped and had a chat with him because I remembered him from City Slickers. And then you run the gauntlet with all the press.
Yeah.
And this is a bit scary because I've never been, in front of press a lot. But there's the radio press, there's the television, there's the there's newspaper, there's foreign press. So that was a good night. It was a wonderful night. We went out afterwards and celebrated, of course, and I think we got 7 Academy Awards out of the 11 nominations.
Wow.
And then it came time the next day back to the hotel, and the hotel was filled with flowers, boxes of champagne from people, faxes. There was no email sent. Faxes by the score. Telephone didn't stop ringing.
Yeah.
Interviews on the telephone. I did my first television interview that afternoon, morning Sydney time with Ray Martin. But that was fun. I did another interview for another television network. Got on the plane to come home. Got on the Qantas Flight 12, my favourite, to come home.
Yeah.
And the stewardess, the hostess said, "Mr. Senra, do you have it with you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "The Oscar, do you have it with you?" And I said, "Yes, I do." We're up in first class.
Yeah.
And she said, "Do you think it's prudent that you could show it to people in the plane?" I said, "Hey, you've got 300 people that have been flying for 7 hours. They've got 8 to go. They're all tired and grumpy. The toilets, there's a queue to the toilets. I don't think they want to see somebody holding a trophy in front of it."
Yeah.
She said, "I think you'll find they do." So I said, "All right, all right." So I did the tour of the plane, and even in first class, they all stood up and clapped and cheered.
Wow.
And took pictures, and I posed with everybody. And I then realised how important it was to my country.
Mm. Yeah, it was. Let me tell you about my experience of that, that moment when you won the Oscar.
Yeah.
I was at home watching on TV. I was 15 years old. And it was only a few months earlier that I'd discovered American Cinematographer in a little old bookshop and had really just been blown away by this entire world about creative visual storytelling. And it all just seemed impossibly far away. I'd never even met a real-life cinematographer. But then there on the TV was an Australian getting the prize as the best in the world at this. And it was a real moment for me, a real turning point, that moment when I thought, maybe this really is possible. This could actually be a career.
Wow, wow. And that's the moment you decided.
Yep, that was it.
Look at that.
That was the moment.
Well, I'm glad to have been part of that, Ben. That's lovely. And what happened then? You were 15.
Yeah, I started making short films, doing wedding videos, and then when I finished high school, got a job at the local TV station and went from there.
Good Lord, good for you.
So it certainly meant a lot to me, but I think it really mattered to a lot of Australians and certainly a lot of Australians in the industry.
All of a sudden, you know, I say I didn't realise what it meant to my country, but it meant a hell of a lot.
Yeah. And it was very important to the ACS as well.
Of course.
You know, there's been many more since, but
yeah.
That one of the ACS members could win the Academy Award was a big turning point, I think.
Yeah. But I did a couple of things in Australia. I went to a little one-horse town, you know, maybe 400 or 500 people, or if that, one little petrol station. And I stopped at the petrol station to fill up. I was on my own. And I filled it up, and the bloke came out. I went to pay him, and he said, "No, mate, this one's on us."
Wow.
I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you're not paying for this, mate." He said, "We're real proud of what you did for your country."
Wow.
And he took my hand, and I drove away literally with a tear in my eye, and I looked in the rear vision mirror, and I could see him still with a hose in his hand, just sort of waving goodbye to me. And that hit home harder than anything. I mean, that was a huge emotional moment for me.
Yeah.
So that was Dances with Wolves.
So The Power of One, tell me about that experience.
Oh, Power of One, I've got some stories on that too. It was directed by a man called John Avildsen, who had directed the first Rocky. He was good and he had a good plan. He actually shot the film on video as we rehearsed with the actors every day. We were down in Zimbabwe in Harare at a little town called Bulawayo. And he shot with his camera every angle, the wide shots, the overs, with the actors, you know, not in wardrobe, but as we rehearsed each scene.
So he kind of had a template.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was very, very well planned. He knew cameras, and the film had to go to London. So it took a while to get there. It took a while to get a report on the rushes, and it took a while. We didn't have the film sent back. We had video sent back.
Right.
Which was really disappointing. It was so hard to see what you were looking at, what you'd shot. But I had this wonderful lab timer in London. But I had a call, an urgent call for him one day. I had a talk to him about dailies. And I rang him up about the rushes. And he said, "Everything is fine, but Mr. Semler, how you see him. He'd never call me Dean. He called me Mr. Simpson.
Yeah.
He said, and he was stammering a bit. He said, Mr. Simpson. And he said, your work is very, very good. He said, and we realised, of course, that you got an Academy Award for your work, of course, but I need to talk to you about one thing. I thought, shit, what have I done? He said, well, could you give us another half exposure of stop on the night stuff? I said, of course. Not a problem.
That relationship between the cinematographer and the colour timer was such an important and powerful one, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely vital. I'd ring up the lab, and as long as you can speak to the timer, you're happy for the day's shoot.
Yeah.
If you can't speak to the timer before you shoot that day, it's not the same. You know, for instance, you can have the timer, and I've had this happen on a location which was remote.
Mm.
I've had the timer call the office and say, you know, scene 77AB, you know, not a quarter of a stop, not a half a stop exposure there would help. It would nicely low key, I might say. So that goes to the office. The office then sends it to the set. Someone on the set gets a call saying, da la la, low key, it's a little bit darker. So it goes to a runner or a PA who comes to the location. By the time it gets to the location, is that your rushes are all pretty dark yesterday. And I've had that happen whereby I thought, oh, I know I was going in that direction, but I may have gone too far.
Yeah.
I'll adjust today. I won't go quite so far.
Yeah.
And so in not going quite so far, you went the wrong way. You were right the day before. And it's just that communication thing that I've had. But the lab relation is incredibly important.
Mm.
I remember on going back to Mad Max 2, when we first used the Ned Kelly, the crash box.
Yeah.
A car on the road hit by the truck went straight into the camera and wrecked a 50mm Panavision lens. And I remember talking to Bill Gooley.
Yeah.
And imagine Bill, it's like 5 o'clock in the morning, he's looking at this stuff, looking at the screen, and all of a sudden, he said, this thing came flying at me, and I ducked. He said, I said, good on you, Bill. The timer is incredibly important, and I've worked with some great timers in Australia, you know, Arthur Cambridge.
Yeah.
Classic down there as well. And great timers over here, Phil Hitos and Mike Stanwyck, who, you know, worked at Deluxe. Most of my work's gone through Deluxe over here. I remember timing one film, I won't even say what it was, but I'd been night shooting the night before, and the only day they could do it was a Saturday, and so I went in straight after a night shoot. It was a fairly straightforward film that they were timing. And I woke up at the end of it, and the timer said, you've got no problems. You've got no problems. He said, you fell asleep about 20 minutes in. I didn't want to wake you. But I'd shot a film. One of the last films I did on film was a film called Dragonfly.
Yep.
With Kevin Costner. I was timing this film at Deluxe in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I was timing it on a Saturday morning because I was shooting XXX with Vin Diesel during the week. And on Saturday mornings, I was busy. And on Saturday mornings, I was going to Deluxe on film with Mike Stanwyck, the timer. And we'd go through a couple of reels, you know, a point here, a point there, magenta here, a little bit of over there. And, okay, I'll see you in a week. We'll make the changes. Then I'd drive straight across 5 minutes away to E-Film. And E-Film were doing the first full-length feature film, which I had shot, but it was the first one they had done, called We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson.
Yep.
And Mel had said, you want to try a digital intermediate on this thing?
Wow.
I said, Mel, that's going to cost a lot of money. He produced it as well as starred in it. He said, it's going to cost a lot of money. I said, it is. He said, it doesn't matter. I'd really like to try it out. Mel was one to try out new stuff.
Wow.
I think he'd had a lunch with George Lucas, and they talked digital, they talked the future.
Mm.
And Mel said, let's do it. So I went to E-Film, and all of a sudden I'm looking at a 25-foot screen, 12 feet high, with a colorist, and I can change the sky a little bit. I can lift, and I did like two reels a whole reel in the rest of the day, not to come back to, but complete it. And I thought, wow, this is just what a way to go. And from then on, I did about 20 films at E-Film after that. Some originated on film, but mostly on digital. And I used to be there before the doors open. I looked forward to that process.
It's a wonderful process, isn't it?
So much. But the timers were good. The colorists were good. They spoke a different language.
Yep.
and the colourers, but all of them had been trained on film, so they knew the basics of film exposure, etc.
That would have made the communication a lot easier, I imagine.
Oh, of course. Yeah, they understood. They knew, and also they had huge digital knowledge as well, which I didn't have. You know, I didn't know a pixel from a megabyte.
One of the biggest things about digital grading is having that control over contrast that you really never had in photochemical grading.
Of course, yeah. But also one of the biggest downfalls of digital is that every cop and his brother comes in there while you're timing. The producer will come in, the editor will come in, the director obviously will be there, and they'll bring in the gardener, they'll bring in their wife. And I've actually had the financial controller of one film came in and I was colour timing him. He said, that door, wouldn't that be better if it was a green rather than a blue?
Oh, dear.
I thought, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
So that's something you have to be patient with. But
the risk that everyone thinks they're an expert.
Exactly, yeah. That also happens on set now, shooting digitally.
It's probably the biggest downside of shooting digitally, isn't it?
It's terrible. You know, I've had actors come up behind me and say, I want to be darker, I want to be lighter. And I've kicked people out of the set. I had a person from Disney, one of the executives from Disney, come in when I'm shooting Maleficent. And I had a shot of Angelina, which I hadn't finished working on. And it was a shot which was very difficult to get her light right. But I was still working on it. The tent doors flew open and this woman from Disney came in and said, "She looks terrible. She looks terrible. What are you going to do?" And I was in a bad mood anyway that way. And I wasn't feeling well. And I said, "Man." And this is what I said. I said, "Please get out of my tent and don't ever come back." She didn't come back. You know, it's very difficult because a lot of your magic's been taken away. Not that it was magic, but...
But there was a mystery to the process.
Yeah. I mean, it's good because you can go home at night and sleep.
There's that.
You don't have to worry about focus and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I had one focus puller who was very, very good, but, you know, you're on a 250mm lens or a 300mm lens at 2,
yep.
And you've got Meryl Streep in a huge close-up, and she sits forward or leans to the side or leans back, and either her eyes are sharp or her ears are sharp, and you've got a guy with no reference, and this is one performance you've got to get right, and this guy goes home at night, and his wife wonders why he's in a bad mood, why he's sulking, why he's worried.
Yeah.
But now he goes home at night, he's seen it.
Knows it's right.
It's good for those guys. It really is. But now also, what I miss, and I shot a film in Canada earlier, and I turn up on set, and I hadn't shot for 3 years. And I'm shooting in Canada, and the camera's set up, and we were on Ari. And I say, "Where's the focus puller?" And I look over in the corner of the room, and there's a stand set up, a little cart, with shelves and with a flag above it to keep the light on, and with a focus puller, remote.
Yeah.
And his own chair, his own stool. I said, "What are you doing over there?" He said, "I've got to pull from here." "Why?" He said, "Well, it's better. I leave the camera free." And I said, "What happened to the days when the camera the assistant used to be by the lens?"
Yeah.
He could see the lens. He could see it. He could see the actor. He knows where the actor is in the space. And then also shooting digitally, the guy I had up there was talking in double Dutch. I was going to say, "Let's pull the 85 and put an 81EF in."
Yeah.
He said, "What?" And, and he'd say, "You need a 21. I said, "What's a 21? He said, "It's the 7-stop ND filter." So that's all changed. You know, the dialogue's different now. Because your filtering is done on board. You don't carry glass filters anymore.
Yeah.
So that's all very different. But, you know, I guess that's the way it's going.
But there is, I think there's a lot of advantages to, not with everything, but a lot of areas hanging on to some of the old terminology and process. Like even just as a first pass of a digital colour grade, working with printer lights just to keep the simplicity of it, just for that initial balance up, I think has a lot of advantages. And then you go into all the bells and whistles.
Yeah, I don't do that. I don't pay much for the colour, so I watch the screen.
Yep.
That's a thought, though, to go back to colour timing points. It's sort of interesting.
Yeah.
I remember Johnny Seals saying to me when I first embraced digital with the Genesis.
Ah, yes.
He said, "Mate, this is the beginning of the end of a cinematographer."
Yeah, I think there's a transition time in a lot of ways. I remember having a conversation with an editor about that in the mid-90s, and he'd seen nonlinear editing and he's going, that's it, it's all over. But of course, as things start to shake out, I think the focus comes back onto the creative aspects, the craft of it.
Certainly, yeah. I was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by a company here a couple of months ago called Banpro. They're like a rental company, like Canopy. They've got big stuff, lots of cameras, lots of lights, lots of things.
Yep.
They had an open house. They wanted to make me their guest, and I went along. And I was talking about the new equipment. I'm talking about Nestor Almendros, who was a great cameraman in the 60s, 70s. He shot a film called Days of Heaven, which was the most beautiful film you could ever wish to see even today, directed by Terrence Malick. But I talked about Nestor, and my gaffer down there had worked with Nestor in New Guinea.
Wow.
And Nestor had described the camera to him. He said Nestor didn't care much about the camera or how it worked. To him, it was a little box with a bit of glass in front, and it enabled him to produce these beautiful images.
Yeah.
So I talked about Nestor when I got this Lifetime Achievement Award at Banco, and said if Nestor had come down here today and seen all this stuff, he would have said, holy shit, I'm coming back, you know. but you've got to be careful.
Yeah.
Producers, et cetera, now that we're shooting digital, I said you've got cameras that can go up to 10, 12, 15,000 ISO. You've got cameras that can do 500, 1,000 frames a second. You've got, you know, limitless possibilities with cameras, but you've got to be careful.
Yeah.
I've always used my cameras on a location where I have tossed a coin as to whether I'm going to light it or not. And there was one instance where it was a restaurant, and it was a big restaurant, and it was low key, but I thought, maybe I can get away with it with a Genesis.
Wow.
So I put the Genesis in there with my lookup table with my camera and on a 14mm lens and dialed it up to, I think, 1200 ASA ISO, and it looked fantastic. It looked really, really good. And the producer was behind me and said, look at that. You're a genius. Fantastic. Now we don't have to light it. I said, hang on. You've got your leading lady walking in through that door.
Yeah.
And then she walks up, he pauses, then she walks over. She sits in front of the camera here in a close-up and delivers a page and a half of dialogue. I said, she's got to look right. I said, I'm going to have to light her in the doorway because your eye needs to go to her. She's going to come across here. She's going to sit down. I have to do the nice wraparound soft lighting because this actress needs it and she has to look beautiful. She's your leading lady. And I'm going to put a bit of light in the windows out there to lift up that side of the room a bit.
Yeah.
The barman, you're not going to see. Let's lift him up a bit. And I think the producer walked away saying, oh, shit, next time I'll get somebody cheaper or something. You know? But newcomers to digital have to be aware of that, you know, just because you can see the set, it doesn't mean to say it's lit.
Yeah. And instead of the technology kind of imposing limits on you, you've got to kind of deliberately do that yourself?
Yes, of course. But there are times when those high speeds are fabulous, like nice streets exteriors and big factories interiors, big buildings interiors. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
But it's always only a start. If you've got actors in there, you generally need to help them out a bit, you know.
Yeah, lighting for the look, not just to get an exposure.
My wife used to go to a gym in Sydney, in Mossman. There was a towel boy there. And Anne went there one day. And Annie had done a course with the official witch of Salem here in Massachusetts. And she now had a little piece of paper, a little thing saying that she was an official white witch.
Wow.
So she goes up to this guy, I'm a white witch. I think you are going to be famous. You're going to be a famous star.
Yeah.
And this kid looked at her and said, who in the hell is this wacko? You know what? Yeah. He said, I can get you an agent. You want to see an agent? Anne rang her agent.
Yeah.
Because Anne was an actress. And her agent said, no, the books are full. Annie said, I think you should see him. So he went in and saw her. And he was working 2 weeks later. It was Hugh Jackman.
Well,
he's sort of done well for a young bloke.
He certainly has, hasn't he? It's amazing how often those kind of random moments in the film industry, you know, absolutely crucial turning points in people's careers.
Exactly. Well, another one, when we were with George Miller, we did Bodyline and The Dismissal. We did those great television series.
Hugely significant miniseries, though, landmarks in kind of the development of the industry here, I think.
You're right. Yeah, they were wonderful. Great actors, great directors. You know, they all did. Phil Noyce directed some, George directed some, George Ogilvy directed some. But we're doing Bodyline, and that was a long shoot.
Yeah.
And Annie would teach tap dancing on the weekend, just for anybody, anybody who wanted to come along. It was a great workout. Old people, young people, the butcher came along. I went along. George Miller came along. We just tap around for an hour. And she said one day, we're going to do a routine at the rap party. And I said, no, we're not. She said, yes. And I said, no, we're not. She said, yes, we're not. I said, there's no way you're going to get me to dress up and tap dance in front of my group, an electric thing. But we did, of course. So George and I and production designer and the continuity girl and Annie and one other person did this routine. And there were about 500 people at the rap party. It was huge. And we did this routine and they went nuts. They just went crazy for it. So we did it twice and it was so much fun. Cut to a little while later and George enjoyed it so much. He felt so good doing it.
Yeah.
He said, I've never felt like that before. He said, it planted a seed. And that seed was Happy Feet.
Isn't that amazing?
So after that, he made Happy Feet. And he thanked Sam for it when he got an Academy Award for it.
Again, something random that totally worked out.
Exactly. That's crazy, yeah.
One of the things that keeps coming up in this conversation, when you're talking about serious films, when you're talking about funny films, when you're talking about action films, how often a sense of fun comes to the surface.
I always have fun, whether it's a heavy drama or there's only one film I didn't have fun on. I hated every minute of it. I hated the director. I hated the actor. I loved my crew.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you who it was or where it was.
Yeah.
But I'm always early. I'm always like at least 45 minutes, an hour early.
Wow.
And my key grip and my gaffer, we're certainly always there. We always try and race each other to be early. In fact, on one shoot in a studio here, it was quarter to seven and I hadn't turned up. I'm normally there at six. And my gaffer and grip started bringing the police and hospital coming where I was. But I'm always early and I like to have a cup of tea and a walk around. So by the time everyone gets there, you know, I'm feeling like a normal human being and I've got some ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
I enjoy it all. And I go back to George Miller, who had a saying that he likes to keep a circle of grace around the camera.
Wow.
And he got that from working with me and from working with John and working with Andrew.
Yeah.
That you just respect everybody in their department. You respect the director, obviously. You respect the actors. The actors are coming out. They could be terrified. They're about to do a scene that's going to be there forever.
Yeah.
They've got to remember their lines. They've got to remember their looks. They've got to remember their mark.
And they've got to be emotional and vulnerable.
Yeah, and you've got to be aware of that.
Mm.
You've got to be aware of makeup and wardrobe and hair. You've got to be aware of everybody around the camera of sound. Have fun. Keep it quiet. Once they're there, just show respect to everybody, you know? And I mean, there are times when you're doing a fun scene and a dance routine or a fight or something where a director might be next to you screaming and yelling. Well, that's not a circle grace around the camera. That has to be done. But I also like to keep a sense of humour with my camera.
Yeah.
Whether it's a drama or not. You know, and I've taught my guys over here a lot of Australian slang to help that out a little bit.
Yeah,
like, let's put a topper on this line. You don't call it a topper, you call it a Dennis Hopper. So they all now over now. My crew now, let's put a Dennis on there now. It's a topper. Or, give us a break. We're going to the dunny. And, you know, you keep it light.
Yeah.
You keep it fun. You keep it serious. I was supposed to award a dolly grip 2 weeks ago who got a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Prem Operators Guild. I'll tell you a story about this grip and around camera. There's a scene with Kevin. It was in Dragonfly where Kevin is talking to a young girl in hospital with cancer. She's dying. She's 6 years old. And Kevin's sitting on the bed talking to her with this incredibly emotional scene. The dolly had a dolly in and time it to get there on the exact word, and it was about a minute and a half dolly. So this grip moose was pushing the dolly. He had the script on the back, so he's reading it as he's going, and he's got it marked on the script where the mark's on the track where he should be. And I'm watching him on the first take, we're shooting film, and he's got tears welling in his eyes. And I think, wow, that's the guy who's getting involved with his job. And he did it on the second take as well.
Wow.
And I said, wow, Moose, when we had the shot, it's extraordinary you're getting in there like that. He said, mate, it wasn't for that. He said, we're a bloody hour and a half late for lunch. George used to depend on the operators, and generally that was me and all that earlier stuff.
Yeah.
And if I said it was okay, it was okay. He could tell when I brought my head away from the eyepiece whether it was good or not.
Yeah, I've heard him say that, actually, yeah.
And Mel said that to me when I worked with him recently. He said, you know, you pulled your head away. I knew whether I had it or not, the way you pulled your head away from the camera. Operating is such an important job, and it's such a lucky job.
Yeah.
I think it's the best job on the set, to be the first one, be the first person to see the music. And I did a film, this is with Billy Crystal, called City Slickers, and two things. I lit a scene up there one night in a storm where they're on horseback and it's raining and it's night and there's wind and they've all got big hats on, cowboys.
Yeah.
And I lit it dramatically. And Billy came up to me afterwards. We saw the dailies.
Yeah.
He said, Dino, he said, this can't be too dark. He said, I know it's a dark scene, but this is comedy. We've got to be able to see a bit more of it. So I learned that then and there from Billy Crystal and always respected it. But I had an operator there who would pull his head away from the camera, and he'd pull his head away and say, oh, damn, oh, because he might have had a bump or... Yeah. Framed a C-stand, or Billy came up to me and said, I got trouble with your operator. Every time we call cut, he never looks at me. He just looks away and pulls his head at me. It throws me. It really throws me because I know that's going to happen every day. I said, all right. And I didn't want to talk to him, so I just fired the guy, which was the best thing because he became a cinematographer about a month later and was, I still see him today. He's shooting very successfully. But I had another operator there as well up on a crane, and there was a sunset shot of like 150 cattle and 8 actors on horseback riding out across the plains in the sunset. It was beautiful. And the actor, the director up top said, I've got a flare. I've got a flare through a car behind a tree. I said, how bad is it? He said, well, that's a flare. And I said, well, we've got to shoot it. He said, I can't shoot it. I said, mate, you have to shoot it.
Yeah.
You have to shoot it. We shot it, and it was nothing. It was a tiny little speck of light, which could have been anything, you know. So it's people like that protecting their jobs.
Yeah.
As I think Johnny Peel talked about, you know, people over here...
Yeah, absolutely.
...protect their jobs or they get fired very, very easily, you know?
But it's not necessarily protecting the film.
Yeah, and DPs get fired, you know, if the dailies don't look good, that's why they do time dailies over here, of course.
Now, another film that must have been a lot of fun is The Last Action Hero with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
This was a huge Hollywood picture. I mean, there was a set built on Sony that... must have cost $1 million that we shot in, and there's about 30 seconds on the screen. It's crazy the money they spent on that.
Yeah.
But it was a privilege there. You know, we're so lucky. I worked on that with two actors who are sort of legendary, like Art Carney from The Honeymooners.
Wow.
And Anthony Quinn.
Wow.
And just to rub shoulders, like the William Holden story. God knows how lucky are we. But I was, I wasn't hugely overweight there. I was sort of a good weight. But Arnold caught me one morning, I was having a burrito, I was having for breakfast, he came up and he said, how tall are you? And I said, I'm 6'1". He said, you would be taller if you weren't so round. That's what he mean? He said, have strawberries. He said, I have a kilo of strawberries. I said, all right, I'll thank But he was wonderful to work with. There were always clones of him everywhere. You know, there was the one that did the flights, there was the one that did the bike riding. There was the one that did the falls. There was the one that did the flying. And there were always like a few of these guys walking around that you thought were Arnold, all smoking cigars and stuff. I heard a story from a producer friend who'd worked with him in the early days, way before this, who said that Arnold rang him one morning. He was about to shoot a picture with him and said, I can't do it. He said, I am 1 pound overweight. So he wouldn't do it. He went to the gym and he worked out until he was right.
Wow. So how soon after that did you shoot The Three Musketeers in Europe?
On a Friday morning, about 6 o'clock in the studio, and I got on a plane at 11. It was Swiss Air to Austria, and it was the 25th anniversary of The Sound of Music.
Oh, really?
And the plane was decked out. Everyone was dressed up like Julie Andrews or whatever, and we all sang The Sound of Music, and I think if you followed the plane along, it would be like a cartoon plane, you know, rocking and rolling left and right. Never get away with it now. But that was a film with the Wild Bunch boys again, with Charlie and Eva Sutherland, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a wonderful experience shooting over there, shooting on film. But I'd said to the studio, I think it was Disney, it was with Joe Roth, who had produced both the Young Guns films. He really liked me because the Young Guns films did very well and we did them on time and it was good, et cetera. So he was producing this. And I rang up him and then said to the, get in touch with the studio. I can do this. We're in Austria. Let's shoot it on movie cam.
Yeah.
Because that's where they're made.
Yeah.
I'll shoot it on, let's use a German film stock. who is a German lad.
Yeah.
German land. I mean, let's go that way. It'll save money on the budget. It'll be wonderful.
Yeah.
I got word back. We want to use Panavision. We want to use Kodak. We want to use the lab in London. So I said, all right, thank you very much. That's exactly what I wanted. So that was one of those big films that was really spectacular in a historic city like Vienna.
Mm.
And we went to Cornwall. We shot in Cornwall as well. And Charlie Sheen up to his tricks, you know, with all the ladies chasing him.
Now, another film that I wanted to ask you about is The Bone Collector.
And this was a film, the first film I had done with Angelina, when she was just tweeting on being a big star. She was just bordering on it. And Phil Noyce directed it. Phil Noyce asked me to shoot it. Mm. But I was so glad because I'd attempted to direct a couple of films before this. And I say attempted to because I was no good at it. In fact, after screening the second film, which was a Steven Seagal thing, which I never talk about, ever, 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 it was so bad. It was so bad that I screened it and I wanted to, this is serious, Ben, I wanted to quit the business totally.
Really?
And I was going to come back to Sydney, get another job, get a plumber, I'll be anything.
Wow.
But I had gone Hollywood. I had a friend who wanted to be a manager.
Yeah.
So he wanted to manage me. He wanted to get me new agent, so I had to say goodbye to Creighton, who had looked after me for so many years.
Yeah.
And I had a director's agent. In fact, I had two agents out of one of the major William Morris agencies.
Mm.
So now I'm pure Hollywood, Ben.
Wow.
And it just didn't work. It just didn't work, you know. I had a good crew. I really liked the crew, but I didn't know how to work with actors. You need experience to do that.
It's a surprisingly complicated thing. Directing, isn't it?
Being a director is like being pecked together by 1,000 penguins.
It's a very evocative description.
I know Kevin Reynolds, who directed Waterworld, said, when you direct, he said, you just get sick and tired of hearing your own name all day.
Mm.
Oh, Kevin. Mm. Oh, Kevin. Oh, Kevin there. Hey, Kev. You hear it all day. You're sick of that. So I was glad to move on, and what made me, what I was so thrilled about was getting this offer from Phil, whom I hadn't worked with for many, 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 many years. He'd done lots of films without me, but he asked me to shoot The Bone Collector.
Mm.
And it was like a huge ray of sunshine that hit with Phil. That had got to doing camera tests, and we had Kodak, we had Fuji. He liked Fuji for some reason. Philip was very particular about the slightest differential in a look. I like Kodak. I'd always done Kodak. And we'd done tests. I'd done a 500,000. I'd done everything with both stock, dark light, inside, outside, candlelight, you name it. And I hadn't decided, but I was driving to the office on this day. The office rang and said, we have to know today what stock you're shooting on. We have to order it. We're shooting in 2 weeks. You're going to need 30,000 feet or whatever for your first few days.
Yep.
We have to order it in. I'm going in with a driver, and there's a giant shadow looms over the road in front of me, and I look up, and it's the Fuji blimp. No joke. I'm not kidding.
Wow.
This is true. It was the Fuji blimp. They were covering a golf tournament in Montreal.
Wow.
And I said, all right, I'm looking for a sign, but that's a big sign. So we shot Fuji.
A sign from the sky.
Yeah, and that was with Angelina and with Ed O'Neill. Do you remember Married with Children?
Yes.
Ed O'Neill was one of the stars in that, obviously. He was the lead in that. But he was also one of the stars in Bone Collector. And we'd been shooting on one set, which was cramped into this con man studio. But the whole set of Denzel's apartment was built on this stage with no room either side for anything.
Wow.
And it was very difficult to shoot in. Phil wanted different angles on Denzel in bed. Denzel spends the movie as a quadriplegic in bed. And Phil had always said, every day, he said, right, a case of Foster's for anyone who'd come up with a new angle on Denzel in bed. So that was the challenge.
Yeah.
But Ed O'Neill was there every day as well. And we shot on that set for about 6 weeks, and it was on our last day. And I was so glad to get out of it and get on location. And I said to Ed, our last day, mate, last day, 6 weeks on one bloody set. He says, hey, I sat on that couch on Married with Children for 11 years. What are you talking about?
Keep it in perspective.
Yeah.
Now, tell me about shooting We Were Soldiers with Mel Gibson.
I remember when he first came out to do the makeup test, he was in his military uniform and I was behind camera. He said, "G'day." He said, "Nothing's changed, really." I said, "No, nothing's changed." It was dangerous. There were choppers, there were guns. And I used an effect on that, which I was very proud of, which was called the Lacopodium effect. And Lacopodium is a very, very fine, perfectly minuscule cylindrical powder.
Yeah.
That's formed inside a tropical plant. And they used to use it in the early part of the 20th century, end of the 19th century, in those long flashbulb plates.
Really?
And they'd ignite it and it'd explode into a bright light and be gone. So I wanted to try some of this out. So the special effects guy came up with a powder and we did some tests and it worked beautifully.
Wow.
So I'd have this stuff up on cherry pickers, up, you know, 40 or 50 feet, and we had a container with aluminium powder in it and an air jet
yep.
built into the thing and a burning pilot light above it. And I had three or four of these spread around the set, and I'd be next to camera, and I would cue them when to go off in relation to Mel's dialogue
wow.
or the scene so that they're not being wasted. And it was like conducting an orchestra, but it's absolutely brilliant because I could
wow.
really underlie the scene. And there's some stuff in there where Mel is talking to Barry Pepper. At certain times when he looks around in the right direction, I'd cue the light and you'd see this.
Wow.
And they worked very, very well. So I was proud of that in that.
Yeah.
But the sad part was that it blew aluminium dust all over the crew's cars. That was very hard to get off. But, after that, I went on to a film called I Did the Nutty Professor. It was one of the, Eddie Murphy was, to me, is an absolute, he goes beyond genius. Every day, he would be 4 to 5 makeup hours every day in a
wow.
chair. Sit for 4 or 5 hours in a chair.
That's brutal.
So he'd come out on Monday by about lunchtime. We would have rehearsed the scene with his stand-in
yep.
and the other actors. He had a great stand-in who would tell him what to do, basically. I started here, moved over here, sat there,
yeah.
turned around here, did that. And then we'd shoot with Eddie for 2 or 3 or 4 hours, and then we'd wrap.
Wow.
Or we'd do other pickups at the end. And he would do the same next day as a different character.
Wow.
There's a scene in there where there are all of his characters. There's Eddie as Eddie. There's Eddie as Clump. There's Eddie as his mother, as his grandmother, as his brother, as his father.
Yeah.
And all of them needed to be go through that 4-hour makeup thing. Well, obviously, we couldn't do it in one day.
Yeah.
So we sat around the table, those that were alive and available, like Janet Jackson, the little kid, and
yep.
one other person. I think there were 3 who didn't have to go through makeup. The others were all a stick with a green tennis ball on it. Eddie had a walk-in as one character.
Yeah.
Relate to each one of those sticks. Sit down,
wow.
continue the scene relating to everybody with the dialogue, with improvising dialogue.
It's incredible.
He would come in the next day and do the next person.
Wow.
And what, you know, what a hero, what an absolute hero.
Yeah.
And why he wasn't nominated, why he didn't get an award for that, it was by far the greatest actor you could ever wish for.
Wow.
And I love the guy, and he was real friendly, but I'm just sorry he didn't get it for that.
Yeah, yeah.
While we're talking about comedians, what was it like working with Jim Carrey on Bruce Almighty?
Jim is a genius as well. To me, he's the greatest physical comedian almost of a century. You know, you go back to the early days, but he's just so phenomenal and he works so damn hard.
Yeah.
And gets up into a sweat so quickly and improvises so much.
Yeah, he's the real heir to Buster Keaton.
Yeah, yeah. We shot in several stages at Universal, which were air conditioning down to about the high 40 degrees. They were cold. They were really, really cold. I don't know what that is in Celsius. But they were cold because he would work so hard. I mean, there's a scene where he's just in his little jockeys there acting, and we would shoot it. I thought he's got to be cold, but he would shoot at the scene. I'm standing next to camera, and I'm so lucky to be here witnessing this for this guy. And he'd do the scene for maybe 2 minutes, do another take. And he was in a ball of sweat. And then he'd go and wipe himself down and change and do it again. That's why it was cold.
That's extraordinary.
You know, going to work with people like that. We're real lucky, Ben, you know.
Good actors are a wonderful thing, aren't they?
Oh, they're so good. My favourite, I think, is Mel. Mel has got a switch he can switch on. He's either an actor or he's Mel.
Wow.
And he doesn't get into the method stuff. The only time I've seen him close was when we did We Were Soldiers, and there's a scene at the end where the battle is over and he's got his, you know, most of his boys have been killed, and or a lot of his boys have been killed. Barry Pepper comes up and says, "I don't know how to tell this story." And Barry's almost in tears, and Mel is breaking down. And Mel says, "Son, you have to tell it." He's crying, and I've never seen him so emotional in a scene as I did in that one scene of all the films I've done with him. I mean, I did them in the same film as there's a scene where he comes back from Vietnam to meet his wife, who doesn't know he's coming back, and he knocks at the door, and she opens the door, and there's this huge reunion, very emotional reunion with him and his wife and the kids. She didn't know he was still alive. And it's a very powerful, very emotional scene, crying and laughing. And we're just about to shoot it, and Mel said, "Dad, did you hear the one about the..." So he told me a joke. And he's just telling me the joke. He gets to the end of the joke, and I'm about to laugh. And they say, "Okay, roll camera, here we go." So we roll camera, he does the scene.
Wow.
And then there's cut camera at the end, but he says, "Well, hey, what do you think of that joke?" You know, so he's got a switch.
Wow. There's one level of skill to be able to get into character, but it's a whole different level of skill to be able to switch straight out of it again.
And he's got it. He's wonderful.
Wow.
And speaking of Mel, we're getting into Apocalypto. He rang me up and said, "You know anything about digital cinematography?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." You know, I wasn't going to say no.
Yeah.
I said, "Yes, and I've done a couple of preliminary tests on the genesis of Panavision." So we went to Panavision. They had us a dog and pony show. We were worried about the heat and humidity in the jungle. We were worried about wanting to get 48 frames out of it. There were only like three or four Genesis cameras out there then. We were worried about getting 48 frames. Panavision carriers guaranteed us we could get that. So we chose to go with Genesis. His film was pushed a little bit. And so in the meantime, I did Click with Adam Sandler, which was the first film shot in Hollywood on the Genesis. And I shot it there because we were in Hollywood. Panavision was 20 minutes away.
Right, so there was a safety net.
Yeah, and E-Film gave me my lookup table, which they call a colour stream, which emulated 5219. And the image I was getting on that monitor was the same as I would get from a 1519 meg.
Wow.
And it was like the 25 across the lights in the Sydney lab.
Wow, you know? How fantastic.
So I knew exactly where I was.
Wow.
So E-Film were handy as well. This was a new tool for them. They're rocket scientists that designed it as the Sony and Panavision people designed the camera. And in doing Click, I learned a lot. My crew learned a lot. You learn by going into the dark room. There's no film in there. There's nothing. It was a bit scary.
Yeah.
But the crew got the hang of it very quickly. And because Panavision had made the camera as film-friendly as possible for the crew. So for the operators, it was easy. For the focus pullers, it was easy, et cetera, et cetera. So I did Apocalypto on the Genesis and put it through the roof. I absolutely
punished
took it into orbit, you know.
Yeah.
It was like shooting by firelight without lighting, shooting in the daylight. There's a scene in the daylight there with the big guy who's running around naked in the village in the jungle because his genitals were on fire from rubbing chili flakes on them. The whole village were watching him laughing. I had three cameras up, three Genesis up. It's a big scene.
Yeah.
Mel was concerned about getting it done. It was getting mid-afternoon. He said, "I know it gets dark in here. Can we get it done?" I said, I'll do all I can.
Yeah.
So I hopped in the tent and I just called it as we went. I said, "Okay, pull the zooms and put primes on."
Wow, yeah.
But before I did that, I went through, you know, let's go 600, let's go 300, let's go 200, let's go 100. Okay, let's pull the zooms, put the primes on.
Yep.
Put the primes on. Start at 2.8, this will went out to. Let's go to half a stop gain, so we'll get a half stop gain.
Yeah.
Let's go to a 270 shutter when it's sitting darker.
Wow.
Let's go to a full stop gain. Let's go to 360 degree shutter.
Wow.
So I'm now at something like 3,000.
Wow.
And Mel finally says, "Mel's been saying that it's getting dark out here. You sure you know what we're doing?" And I said, "Yes. Just keep shooting. You're okay." The crew are saying, "We can hardly see what's going on." So we got it and he said, "That's fantastic. We got it."
Yeah.
I stepped outside and then I had a light meter then.
Yeah.
I pulled it out and it was reading 1.5 foot candle. And that scene, or wow, parts of that scene, about a quarter of that scene, was shot under those conditions, and it cuts into the film, wow, daylight.
Isn't that incredible?
So I was thrilled to death for that. John, yeah, McCarbone had shot there on Medicine Man with Sean Connery a couple,
oh,
yes, of years,
yeah,
before, in the same piece of jungle in Mexico.
Wow.
So I rang up Macca and I was boasting. I said, "Hey, Macca." I said, "What did you do when it got dark?" I said, I reckon I got an extra 2 hours every day.
Wow.
Shooting on the Genesis in, yeah, the jungle gear. I said, "What did you do? How did you get away?" He said, "Mate, we just wrapped and went back to the pub." I said, "All right. Okay. Okay."
Wow. And I guess that's the thing with digital, is there's situations like that where it allows you to do more. It doesn't fundamentally change the craft. It just allows you to do more than you could do before.
Exactly, yeah, you bet. And you're not doing it better. You're doing the same, but you're doing it more. I met Ed Harris. He was directing a film called Appaloosa, a Western, which, yep, I'm very proud of. It's a good Western film. Mm. We shot, it was my 7th movie in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Wow.
And I had to meet... I had to meet Ed Harris, the actor who was directing it and acting in it as well, with Viggo Mortensen and Renee Zellweger. So I met with Ed. He was in his trailer on the back lot at Universal. And I went and he shook my hand and we said hello. He said, "You read the script?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I love it." He said, "Good, good." He said, "I like it." He said, "You're the guy that shoots digital now, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, I could go both ways. I could shoot film."
Yep.
He said, what do you think about this? Would you shoot this on film?" I said, "I certainly would. I think it'd be good."
Yeah.
He jumped up out of his chair, shook my hand, and he said, "You can do it."
Wow.
So we shot on film.
Yeah.
And it went well, except the rushes go out. They go to a lab in Sydney. They go through a flight.
Mm.
They go through screenings at airports. They come back. They're screened again. And we got stuff back like 5 days later or 4 days later that have been contaminated sometimes, wow, with flashes, through x-rays and things, sometimes with focus problems that you really couldn't see. This is on tape. We're seeing it on tape.
Yep, yep.
So they're the sort of original old nightmares that come with shooting film.
Yeah, that you just don't have with digital.
But another story with that film, we had a scene with Ed Harris and Viggo Mortensen, a very dramatic scene with the two of them at a little table in a bar in a country town. And the road's outside, and a couple of buildings opposite, period. And they're having a tequila and having a little cigar, whatever they call it, a cheroot.
Mm.
And the scene is about Renee Zellweger, who they were both fancying, they were both liked, and they both had relationships with. And they're relating her to a praying mantis who devours the male after sex. And that's the scene. And it wasn't played funny, it was played serious and heavy.
Yep.
Well, we had a praying mantis on the glass window that was climbing outside as part of the scene.
Yep.
We're 2/3 of the way seen through the scene, and the animal wrangler, you have to have an animal wrangler now, whether you've got an ant or an elephant.
Yeah.
The animal wrangler says, "We've got to cut." He said, "Why?" "We've got to cut because the praying mantis is getting smoke in its eyes from the cigar." We said, "You're joking." She said, "No." And you have to respect it. She wrote it down on paper. The praying mantis wasn't, in this clear environment. So we had to seal the window and then we shot it. I don't know what that's got to do with cameras, but it's funny because when I shot that on film, I'd already done 5 or 6 films on the Genesis. And I'm getting films from producers saying, "What's wrong with digital? Why can't you shoot digital anymore? What's wrong with the Genesis?" I'm saying, hang on, it's all right.
Whatever's appropriate for the particular project.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever the director wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the DP, I then shot Secretariat, which was a good Genesis film, a really good film for the Genesis. I had 3 cameras a lot on that, long lenses. And then I also used on that a little Olympus camera. This is before the GoPro. This is a tiny little Olympus camera, which I had on a long painter's pole about 15 feet. With the operator with a little 7-inch monitor at the end, wow, in a utility driven by a stunt guy right alongside the horses or 15 feet away. So he could put this camera literally 2 inches above the ground right behind the horse's hooves at,
wow,
35, 40 miles an hour. So I got some spectacular stuff on that. And if you see the film, there's lots of stuff there. I could get because we had real jockeys, we didn't have actors. The actor playing the lead was a jockey, or the jockey who was playing the lead was a jockey playing an actor, you know what I mean? And we could get in on his hands, we could get in on his face, we could strap this camera under the horse's belly, wow. We could get in the horse's nostril. And it's extraordinary, extraordinary stuff that really broke the ground. George Miller came over, I had dinner with him over here. He said, I want you to do Fury Road. He said, just hear about what you're doing with new cameras. So that was a long time ago.
Now, you came back to film again for In the Land of Blood and Honey with Angelina Jolie.
Land of Blood and Honey. Angie rang me and said, would you like to read the script of the story? I said, I would love to.
Mm.
And then I read it and said, I'd love you to come and see me. So I went to see her. She had a room booked at the Roosevelt Hotel, a legendary room in where Marilyn Monroe used to be in Hollywood. And I went there, I met with her, and we talked and laughed. And she said, she said to me on the phone before I went there, she said, well, who would you get to shoot it? And I said, I'd like to do it myself. And she said, later on, she said, I literally danced around the room. I was so happy that you could do it. So we met and we decided to do it and agreed to do it. She wanted to do it on film. And we shot Kodak. Angie was wonderful. She needed a shoulder to lean on. I had Mark Galbeck, who was a very good support for me. And Angie was wonderful every day. And she presented me with an award at the ASC. I got the Lifetime Achievement, which she presented. I said, look, every day I've got to sit right next to you at this monitor. That's right next to you.
Mm.
For 10, 12 hours a day, 5 days a week for 8 weeks. I wake up some mornings and think, I just don't want to go to work today. And she laughed. But that was wonderful that she did that. She was very good. She was very much into performance, very much into, from an actor's point of view. And we shot it in two languages, which she chose to do like 2 weeks, 3 weeks before shooting.
Wow.
And the producers went nuts. They thought, well, here's another 2 or 3 days shooting if we're going to have to do every scene twice. But we didn't. And the one to watch is the one in their language, their local language.
Really? Wow.
With subtitles. That's much more powerful than the English version. All of a sudden, then, you know, I'm still shooting digital, but now all of a sudden the old Genesis is starting to call it a dinosaur, you know? Because the Alexa came out.
Yeah.
The Sony F55 comes out. And I did some films with Steve Carell.
Oh, yes.
And I did Get Smart with him. I was talking to him about the...
Gosh, that was a hilarious film.
It was good, wasn't it?
Yeah.
we shot that in LA and in Montreal. And that restaurant I talked about testing was the one in Montreal where her and where Steve and Anne Hathaway are having dinner.
Right, yeah.
And then we shot in Russia. They didn't want to shoot in Russia because Steve Carell, I don't think, wanted to go there. The director didn't want to go there, but because the director had lunch with George Lucas, and George said, come on, you don't have to go to Moscow. Shoot it virtual. You can shoot plates and shoot green screen. So he convinced Peter, the director, and the producers to do that. So we laid out some green screen, and it was going to be, it would have worked, but it would have, it would have been so far from the truth. And we're about to go to, we're about to do the scene. We're, you know, a month off or something. And I said to Pete, I'm really concerned about that. I think we should go to Moscow to feel Mother Russian, Mother Earth under our feet.
Yeah.
It's the people, feeling the light, the river. So they decided to. So we did go. And we took a lot of the crew. And we wrapped actually on Red Square at 4 o'clock one morning, just as the sun was coming up. And it was a beautiful way to finish the film. But with Steve Carell, I talked to him about digital versus film.
Mm.
He said, with digital, he cannot hear the camera running. No matter how close it is to him, he can't hear it. He said, with film, I could always hear the little...
Yep.
I could always hear that. And he said, it used to concern me when the assistant would say to the director, I've got enough left for one take. He said, I was always concerned that it was going to run out. And it was somehow... psychologically, it'll affect my performance.
Wow, that's interesting.
Well, I love Genesis for that reason.
Wow.
Angie got the Board of Governors Award with the ASC about 2 years after she presented me with the award.
Yeah.
And she wanted me to present her with that award.
Return the favour.
So I did. She was wonderful, yeah. I was shooting in Winnipeg, shooting Heaven Is For Real, a true story about a little six-year-old kid who went to heaven when he almost died. It's a film well worth seeing, directed by Randy Wallace, who had done Secretariat, that I shot with a great crew. I wondered, how the hell am I going to get a crew in Winnipeg?
Yeah.
You know, the middle of nowhere. It's the coldest city on the whole continent of America, only comparable to one town in Mongolia. It's going to be freezing. I'm not going to get a crew there. But that was bullshit. It was cold, yes. Mm. But the crew were fantastic.
Wow.
I had crew from Vancouver, camera, but the rest, Rhythm Electrics, was absolutely wonderful.
Fantastic.
While I was there, Angie had asked me to do Unbroken, Louis Zamperini movie.
Mm.
And she'd asked me to shoot that. She'd given me the book. She'd given me the script. I'd shot chess with Louis Zamperini and her, with her interviewing him in his home in Los Angeles, and I was going to shoot the film. It had been delayed, and Randy came up with the offer of this film, Heaven is for Real. And I really wanted to work with Andy. I really wanted to do Unbroken with Angelina. I wanted to do them both. And I knew I possibly couldn't, but Angelina said, if my film gets pushed anymore, I don't want you to miss out on Randy's film.
Wow.
Then you'll have nothing if my film doesn't go. You have 6 or 8 months without work. And her film was pushed. And so I took Randy's film, and then I'd been shooting Randy's for 2 weeks, and I got word that her film was on. She let me know it was on.
Yeah.
That she'd chosen Roger Deakin. And I started to get depressed. I was really depressed because I wanted to do that. And the thing that killed me was seeing a jet in Hawaii with her getting off with Roger Deakin scouting over there. And I was like, yeah, you know, that should have been me, could have been me. But here I am. It's all right.
Wow.
And then I saw him in Australia with my crew. I was like, you bastard. So I'm sorry I didn't do that. I think the film was good, but I don't think it was rough enough.
Hmm.
I think it needed to be dirty, and it wasn't dirty enough. Anyway, that's my comment. But while I was in Winnipeg, I get a package one evening. I get one afternoon on the set delivered to me, a thick FedEx package, and I open it up when I get back to the hotel. And it's got 22 letters from students, fifth grade students in Renmark, who had seen me on television with Angelina. They'd seen me get the award. And they wanted to meet me. They wanted to congratulate me. They wanted me to come down there.
Wow.
22 letters from 22 kids. Things like, hello, Mr. Semler. You are a great cinematographer. They all spelled it right.
Wow.
My name is Amy. I am 9 years old, and I have a dog called Ben. And my favourite colour is blue. And my football team is the Denmark Swans. And we want you to come down here and teach us how to shoot. And I have 22 of these letters.
How extraordinary!
And so it was very moving. I went back to the hotel and I threw a scotch down my throat, and I answered them all. Wow. I answered 22 letters individually to these kids. And then I got more letters back.
Wow.
With more pictures saying, oh, my dad works at Woolworths and we grow oranges, and we really want you to come down and show us how to make films and to see our lovely school. So I thought, I have to go down. Yeah. I can't ignore this. So we went down, and George was just finishing Fury Road. They were shooting some stuff in Sydney. I said hello quickly. We had dinner. I went to Adelaide and went to Renmark, and it was the greatest weekend of my life, I think. It was a wonderful, wonderful weekend. I went to the school, and we made a little video with them. I wrote a little thing, and we shot a video, and they acted in it and starred in it and had ideas and did the slates. I had a slate made up. Bob Harvey made a slate up. I called the film Renmark Rascals, and we had room on it for the slates to be written, and I got the kids to put the numbers in. We had the film cut, and we screened it, and they all went nuts and loved it, and I had a Q&A question. I went to their local theatre, which is really a good theatre, and screened clips from about 30 movies with some background photographs, and had 200 or 300 people turn up in this little theatre and told a few lies and had a few laughs. And I screened Get Smart that night, the story. We loved it. And the next day we went on I rang up an old school friend and said, hey, why don't we just get together and have a beer and maybe a barbie or something when we're down there? He said, yeah, righto, mate. Well, as it turned out, we drove to this little restaurant called Wilkadee that's on the River Murray.
Yeah.
It's in an old shearing shed, 150 years old, that they'd turned into a microbrewery and a little restaurant. There's no inside. It's just outside on the deck on the river. 25 people turned up, students from 1959. Can you believe it?
How amazing.
Colleagues that I went to school with. I hadn't seen them since 1959. That was like 50 years or something.
If you now, having had all these extraordinary experiences and this amazing journey. If you could say something to yourself as that kid in Renmark, what would you say?
It'd have to be a four-letter word, I tell you. I wouldn't believe it in a million years. I mean, yeah. It's funny because while I was in Renmark, they gave me the key to Renmark as well, the mayor.
Wow.
Gave me the key to the city.
Yeah.
And the council chambers where it was handed to me stood on exactly the same spot where the old tin shed railway station was.
Wow.
Where I used to work. There's no railway there anymore.
Yeah.
But it was on exactly the same spot.
Wow.
And, you know, if I had a thought then, God knows, I wouldn't have thought of leaving Renmark.
Yeah.
Let alone going to Adelaide, let alone going to Sydney, let alone going to, God, to Los Angeles and Hollywood. Yeah. Never, ever. Who in a million years would have thought? I mean, I thought of maybe being a missionary or a disc jockey.
What do you think are some of the biggest things you've learnt on that journey?
On most movies, there's a scene that's impossible to shoot.
Yeah.
How in the hell might you go through the script? And the beauty of the business is you read a script and you think, wow, that's nice. But you don't know who's in it. You don't know where it is.
Yeah.
You think, wow, that's good. Then you get ideas of the location. You think, oh, wow, I'll look up some pictures of that.
Yeah.
That's nice. And then they say, oh, we've got, you know, Robert Redford in this and also Mel Street. You think, oh, look, and you read it again with them in it.
Yeah.
And you get to know the script. I read it a dozen times. You get to know it again and again and again. And then you do a location scout and it'll all start to come true.
Mm.
Wow. That's when you start giving ideas.
Yeah.
Then you come back and you see some drawings for wardrobe. You think, fantastic. Then you do the wardrobe and makeup test. And all of a sudden, the whole thing becomes real.
Yeah.
And then you get onto the set and bingo. It's all of that work from everybody, you know, comes to a head. And reminds me of a story when I was shooting Cocktail and we go to Russia's. And I was very nervous because Tom was very particular about the way he looked, Tom Cruise. And we're in there at one stage in the lab looking at the rushes, and I'm looking at Tom's image and I think, God knows, I could have been a half a stop darker on that quite easily, but Tom didn't say anything. Could have been a half a stop darker.
Yeah.
The wardrobe lady was sitting next to me and she nudged me and said, look at that grey thread on those buttons. I wish I'd put black thread on that. So it's like,
yeah,
it's like to each his own.
Yeah.
If everyone thinks with that amount of care and detail,
yeah,
you've got good stuff, you know, yeah. But you know, I'm pretty easygoing, I think, and you mentioned about keeping a sense of humour. I try and keep that on the set, and I don't scream and yell.
Yeah.
But I like to keep the shoot as easy, as calm as possible, and have as much fun as you're allowed to in the time you've got.
Mm. And clearly that can produce extraordinary results.
Yeah, exactly. I think you get everybody on your side,
mm.
and everybody understands, you know, they'll work better for it. I've got a little tag for your story. Starting in Renmark and the Riverland, beautiful fruit grown there. We used to pick fruit. We used to pick peaches and pears, oranges particularly, that were shipped all around the world. I went to a supermarket here in Los Angeles one Sunday morning before it got too crowded. Steven Spielberg was in there with his cart wheeling stuff around. I was in there wheeling. He lives just down the road a bit.
Yeah.
The other side of the hill. I'm not on his side. I'm not on the $40 million side. I'm on the other side. But he was wheeling his cart around. We had a chat for a while. We talked about a couple of things.
Yeah.
Said goodbye, and I just was about to leave, and I watched him. He picked up a bag of oranges, put them in his thing, and then walked away. And I went up afterwards and looked at it, and they were oranges from the Riverland.
Wow.
South Australia. And that's the end of my story.
And what a truly amazing story it is. Dean, thank you so much for sharing this incredible journey with us.
Thanks. Good luck to you, Ben.
Dean Semler, thanks for stopping in.
All right, mate.